It wasn't your technique that stirred up his past, but his sheer resistance to it.
Indeed.
So for each of our Golas, we'll tailor an individualized agony that leverages their own fears and weaknesses.
How can sex break Yui the way it broke the Bashar? Garimi asked.
Not the sex itself, but Yui's resistance to it. He's terrified of remembering his past. If he believes we know how to unlock his memories, he'll fight us with everything he has. As he fights, I will apply my most potent procedures, and he'll spiral over the brink into complete madness.
Garimi shrugged.
If it doesn't work, we have other ways.
The room was dim and the shadows cloying, which made Yui's terror more palpable. The chamber was devoid of furniture except for a padded mat on the floor, like those that the Gola children used during physical training sessions. The witches had not explained what to expect. The young man knew from his studies that the process of regaining one's past was painful. He was not a strong man, nor was he particularly brave. Even so, the prospect of pain did not petrify him nearly so much as the dread of remembering. The door slid open with a gentle hiss of lubricated metal gliding in its tracks. From the corridor, blinding light flowed in, much brighter than the glow panels in his cell. It silhouetted a woman's figure.
Shiana?
He turned to face her and could see only her outline, the sensual curves of her body no longer masked by flowing robes. When the door sealed behind her, his eyes adjusted to the more comfortable illumination. When he saw that Shiana was completely unclothed, his fear increased.
What is this?
His voice, torn by nervousness, came out as a squeak. She stepped closer.
You will disrobe now.
Barely a teenager, Yui swallowed.
Not until you explain what is going to happen to me.
She used the hurricane force of Bene Gesserit voice.
You will disrobe now.
In a spasmodic reaction, his arms and legs jerking, he tore off his clothes. Shiana inspected him, running her eyes up and down his thin, naked body like a hawk assessing its prey. Yui got the impression that she found him inadequate.
Don't hurt me, he pleaded,
and hated himself for saying it.
Of course it will hurt. But the pain won't be anything I inflict upon you.
She touched his shoulder. He felt an almost electric shock, but he was transfixed, unable to move.
Your own memories will do that.
I don't want them back. I'll fight you.
Fight all you wish.
It will do you no good. We know how to awaken you. Yui closed his eyes and gritted his teeth. He tried to turn away, but she grasped his arms to hold him still, then released her grip and began touching him. The delicate strokings felt like the line of heat left by a lighted match down his arm and across his chest.
Your memories are stored within your cells.
In order to awaken them, I must awaken your body. She stroked him, and he shuddered, unable to draw away.
I shall teach your nerve endings to do things they've forgotten how to do.
Another jolt, and he gasped. She touched him again, and his knees buckled, exactly as she wanted. Shiana pushed him toward the mat on the floor.
I need to wrench you into the full awareness of every chromosome in every cell.
No.
The words sounded incredibly weak to him. As she pressed herself against him, letting warm skin ignite his perspiration, Yui tunneled backward into himself, trying to flee. From all he had learned of his past, he found one thing with which to anchor his bravery.
Wana. his beloved Bene Gesserit wife, the weak link in his long chain of betrayals, and the strongest link in his original lifetime. The evil Harkonnens had known that Wanna would be the key to breaking his Sook conditioning, and it had only worked, could only have worked, because Yui loved her with all his heart. Bene Gesserits were not supposed to succumb to love, but he knew that she must have reciprocated. He thought of her pictures in the archives, of all he had learned about her in his researches. Oh, Wanna. He yearned for her in his mind, tried to latch on to her as a lifeline. Shiana stroked his waist, trailed her fingers lower, and climbed on top of him. Yui's muscles were completely out of his control. He couldn't move. Her lips vibrated against the skin of his shoulder, his neck. Shiana was a skilled sexual imprinter. Her body was a weapon, and he was the target. A flood of sensations nearly drove the archival image of Wanna from his mind, but Yui fought against what Shiana was making him feel. Instead, he focused on what he might have done in Wanna's loving embrace. Wanna. As the rhythm of their lovemaking increased, real memories intruded on the information he had obtained through research. Yui recalled those terrible moments after his wife had been seized by the Harkonnens, and saw images of the loathsome fat Baron, his thuggish nephew Raban, the viper Faderoutha, and the mentat Piter de Vries, who had a laugh that sounded like vinegar. Weak, helpless, and infuriated, he had been forced to watch them torture Wanna inside an isolated chamber. She was a Bene Gesserit. She could block her pain, could deflect her body's responses. But Yui could not so easily shunt such things aside, no matter how hard he tried. In his nightmare memory, the Baron laughed, a rumbling basso sound. "See the little chamber she's in, Doctor? A toy with some very interesting possibilities." As the men watched the groggy and disoriented Wanna, she stood on weak knees, but upside down within the booth. "We can convert gravity into a thing that depends entirely on perspective." Raban chuckled, a harsh release of noise. He operated artificial gravity controls in the small room, and suddenly Wanna fell with a thud to the floor. She managed to tuck her head and shoulders just enough to avoid breaking her neck. With the speed and fluidity of a serpent, Piter de Vries scurried forward carrying a pain amplifier. At the last moment, Raban snatched it out of the twisted mentat's hands and applied it to Wanna's throat himself. She writhed with a jagged spasm of agony. "Stop! Stop, I beg you!" Yui cried.
"Oh, doctor, doctor, you know it can't possibly be that easy."
In the vision, the Baron folded his pudgy arms across his chest. Raban twisted the gravity controls again, and Wanna was thrown like a limp doll from wall to wall, smashing into the sides of the chamber.
"When one is too lovely, something must be done to correct that condition."
"My beautiful Wanna."
The memories were so vivid now, far more detailed than anything he had read in the archives section. No mere documentation could have provided such precise clarity. In a different, newly unlocked compartment of his brain, he lived another memory. He was artificially paralyzed, forced to watch during one of the Baron's drunken parties while Piter played a sparking pain amplifier over Wanna's suspended body. Each flash provoked a twitching response of agony from her. The other guests laughed at her pain and at his helpless misery. When he was freed from his paralysis, Yui trembled, drooled, and struggled. The Baron stood over him, a huge grin on his bloated face.
he handed Yui a projectile pistol. As a Sook doctor, you should do everything possible to stop a patient from feeling pain. You know how to stop Wana's pain, doctor.
Unable to break his conditioning, Yui shuddered and spasmed. He wanted nothing more than to do as the Baron demanded.
I can't.
Of course you can. Choose a guest, any guest. I don't care which. See how amused they are by our little game?
Grasping Yui's shaking wrists, he helped the doctor point his projectile weapon around the room.
But don't try any tricks, or we will make the torment last a great deal longer.
He wished he could put Wana out of her misery, killing her instead of letting the Harkonnens have their perverted fun. He saw her eyes, the spark of pain and hope, but Raban stopped him.
Focus, doctor. No mistakes. Through blurred vision, he made out numerous targets and tried to concentrate on one, a tottering old nobleman, a Samuta addict. That one had lived a long life, undoubtedly with considerable debauchery. But for a Sook doctor to kill, he fired.
Overwhelmed by the horrific scene now playing out in his head, Yui paid no further attention to Shiana's ministrations. His body was drenched with sweat, but less from sexual exertion than from the extreme psychological distress. He saw Shiana appraising him. The memories were so clear to him that his entire body felt like a raw wound. Wana in agony, and the sharp, broken crystal pain of how his Sook conditioning had been thwarted. It had happened thousands of years ago. The years before that watershed occurrence, and the years afterward, extended outward, filling his mind, now fresh and hungry. As the relentless memories returned, so did more anguish and guilt, accompanied by a disgust with himself. Yui felt as if he was about to vomit. Tears poured down his cheeks. In the training room, Shiana studied the wet streaks clinically.
You're weeping. Does that mean you've successfully regained your memories?
I have them back.
His voice was husky and sounded infinitely old.
And damn you witches to hell for it.
We have so little trouble finding enemies because violence is an innate part of human nature. Our greatest challenge, then, is to choose the most significant enemy, for we cannot hope to fight them all.
Bashar Miles Teg, Military Assessment Delivered to the Bene Gesserit. After she departed from Chapter House, Mirbella traveled to the battle lines. That was where the Mother Commander belonged. Posing as nothing more important than an inspector for the new sisterhood, Mirbella arrived at Okuliat, one of the systems that lay directly in the path of the advancing thinking machine fleet. Once, Okuliat had been at the far edges of inhabited space, a jumping-off point for the scattering after the tyrant's death. Objectively, this sparsely populated world had little significance, just another target on the vast cosmic map. But for Mirbella, Okuliat represented a genuine psychological blow. When this world fell to the machines, the enemy would be encroaching into the old empire itself, not just into a distant and unknown place that had been omitted from old star maps. Until the Ixians delivered their obliterators and the Guild provided all the ships she had demanded, the Mother Commander had no way to stop or even slow the thinking machines. Under a hazy sky illuminated by watery yellow sunlight, Mirbella stepped out of her ship.
The landing field seemed deserted, as if no one tended the spaceport any longer, as if they were not even watching for the enemy. When she made her way to the frantic crowds in the central city, though, she saw that the inhabitants had already found their own enemy. A mob surrounded the main administration building where government officials had barricaded themselves. The locals had put their leaders under siege, screaming for blood or divine intervention, preferably blood. Mirbella knew the raw power that their fear generated, but it was clearly not channeled properly. The people of Okuliat, and all desperate worlds facing the oncoming enemy, needed guidance from the Sisterhood. They were an already charged weapon that must be aimed. Instead, they were out of control. She saw what was happening and rushed forward, but stopped short of throwing herself headlong into the mob. They would tear her limb from limb, and they would do it for Shiana. The random appearances and sermons of the resurrected Shiana had prepared billions of people to fight. The Shianas had kindled the anger and fervor of populations so that the Sisterhood could manipulate that raw power for their own purposes. Once unleashed, however, such fanaticism became a chaotic force. Knowing they were unlikely to survive against the oncoming machines, the men and women threw themselves into violence, seeking any sort of enemy they could get their hands on, even among their own people. "Face dancers!" someone shouted. Mirbella pushed her way closer to the center of action, knocked aside flailing arms and fists, and cuffed someone on the side of the head. But even stunned, the wild and emboldened people surged onward. "Face dancers! They've been manipulating us all along, selling us out to the enemy!" Those who recognized the Mother Commander's Bene Gesserit unitard backed away. Others, either oblivious or too angry to care, were not swayed until she used voice. Bombarded by the irresistible command, they staggered away. Just one person against the multitude, Mirbella strode toward the colonnaded doorways of the government center, which the people saw as their target. She used voice again, but could not stop them all in their tracks. The shouting and accusatory shrieks rose and fell like a thunderstorm. As she fought her way to the front of the barricade, several of the foremost mob members noticed her uniform and let out a long cheer. "A reverend mother is here to support us! Kill the face dancers! Kill them all! For Shiana!" Mirbella grabbed an elderly woman who had been yelling along with the others. "How do you know they're face dancers?" "We know. Think about their decisions. Listen to their speeches. It's obvious they are traitors." Mirbella didn't believe that face dancers would be quite so obvious that common rabble could detect the faint subtleties. But the mob was convinced. Six huffing men ran by, carrying a heavy plasteel pole that they proceeded to use as a battering ram. Inside the Capitol building, terrified officials had piled obstructions against the doors and windows. Thrown stones shattered the ornamental plaza, but the crowd couldn't break in so easily. Bars and heavy objects blocked the way. Wielded with the strength of panic and hysteria, the battering ram pounded the thick doors, tearing hinges loose and splintering wood. In moments, a wave of human bodies pushed forward. Mirbella called out, "Wait! Why not prove their face dancers before you kill anyone?" The old woman shoved past, eager to get to the officials. She stepped on Mirbella's foot, heard her shouted cautions, then turned to her with a narrowed gaze like a serpent's. "Why do you hesitate, Reverend Mother? Help us capture the traitors. Or are you a face dancer yourself?" Mirbella's honored Matre reflexes came to the fore, and her hand snapped out, cutting into the woman's neck with a blow that rendered her unconscious. She had not meant to kill the woman, But as her accuser fell to the steps, a dozen people surged forward, trampling her to death. Heart pounding, Mirbella pressed against the wall to avoid the brunt of the stampede. If the cry had been taken up, "Face Dancer, Face Dancer," with fingers pointing at her, the crowd would have killed her without thinking. Even with superior fighting abilities, Mirbella could never fend off so many. She backed up farther and took shelter behind the tall statue of a long-forgotten hero of the famine times, shielding herself with its plastone bulk. The screaming mob would crush many of its own members to get into the government building. She could hear cries inside, a discharge of weapons, and small explosions. Some of the trapped officials must have been carrying personal protection. Mirbella waited, knowing it would be over soon. The bloody attack burned itself out in half an hour. The mob found and killed all 20 government officials suspected of being enemy face dancers. Then, still not sated in their thirst for blood, they turned against any of their own members who had not shown sufficient murderous fervor until most of the violence drained away into guilty exhaustion. Standing tall, Mother Commander Mirbella entered the building, where she surveyed the smashed windows, display cases, and artwork. Jubilant murderers dragged bodies onto the polished, tiled floor of the main legislative gallery. Almost 30 men and women were dead, some shot with projectile weapons, others beaten to death, many with such violence that their genders were hardly recognizable. The corpses on the polished stone floor wore expressions of horror and shock. One of the bodies among the bloody mess was indeed a face dancer.
"We were right. You see, Reverend Mother,"
a man pointed at the dead shapeshifter.
"We were infiltrated, but we rooted out the enemy and killed it."
Mirbella looked around at all of the innocent humans murdered to discover one face dancer. What was the economy of bloodshed? She tried to assess it coolly. How much damage could that one face dancer have caused, exposing vulnerabilities to the oncoming enemy forces? All of those lives? Yes, and more, she had to admit. From their elation, it was obvious that the people of Okuliat considered their uprising a victory, and Mirbella could not dispute that. But if this wave of insane vigilantism continued, would all governments topple? Even on Chapter House? Then who would organize the people to defend themselves? Weak minds are gullible. The weaker the thought processes, the more ridiculous the notions they will believe. Strong minds, like mine, can turn that to an advantage. Baron Vladimir Harkonnen, Original Recordings. Despite being unarmed, the Baron sneered into the face of the red-eyed mongrel hound. The growling animal moved toward him on the flagstoned floor, baring its sharp fangs, ready to spring. Fortunately, the Baron had killed the feral creature with a poison dart gun some time ago, and this stuffed mechanical version merely followed a programmed reenactment. The simulacrum went motionless when he gave it a hand signal. An amusing toy. 9-year-old Paolo moved around the trophy chamber, admiring the wild animals on display. The Baron had dragged the boy out on many hunts in the pristine wilderness of Caladan so that he could witness the killing firsthand. It was good for his development and education. Raban had always enjoyed such things, but Paolo had originally been reluctant to engage in the slaughter. Maybe it was some flaw in the genetics. However, the Baron was gradually breaking down his resistance. With vigorous training and a system of rewards and punishments, plenty of the latter, the Baron had almost managed to squash the core of innate goodness in this Gola of Paul Atreides. Weather sats had predicted constant rain and wind for the rest of the week. The Baron had looked forward to going out on a fresh hunt, but the cold and wet would have made for a miserable expedition. He and Paolo were trapped inside the castle. The two had formed a remarkable bond. House Atreides and House Harkonnen. How ironic. But though Paolo was a clone of the hated Duke's son, raised properly, he was turning out more like a Harkonnen. "He is your grandson, after all," the internal voice of Aaliyah nagged at him. Overcoming an urge to shout back at her, the Baron watched four workmen with suspensors hoist an immense stuffed mastophant onto a viewing stand. Yet another nearly extinct creature, this ferocious beast had charged at them across a field last autumn, slashing with its serrated horns. But the Baron, Paolo, and half a dozen guards had opened fire with laser guns, cutting discs and poison flechettes, mangling the creature before it finally fell. What an exciting hunt that had been. Paolo looked at the animated creatures on stands. "Instead of going outside to the wilderness, let's go hunting in here. We can pretend they're not really dead. Then we don't have to worry about getting wet and cold." The Baron looked out at the stormy skies, wondering if the weather was the real reason for Paolo's reluctance. "I don't mind pain, but personal discomfort is another matter entirely." He looked around, assessing possibilities for damage, and grinned. "You're absolutely right, my boy." It pleased him to hear how deep his own voice was becoming. They ordered servants to bring a selection of laser guns, dart pistols, swords, and knives for their next ersatz adventure. When the mechanical systems were activated, the dead animals went into a frenzy all over the trophy room. The two hunters took cover, imagined their danger, and shot the mechanical creatures off of their stands, chopping through prosthetic bones, stuffing, and preserved flesh. Last of all, they activated the huge mastophant and watched it stomp over the debris. Finally catching it in a crossfire of laser gun blasts, they amputated its legs. The beast crashed to the floor, its automatic servos writhing. The Baron found the violence to be eminently satisfying, and even Paolo seemed to warm to the activity. Afterward, the brave hunters surveyed the damage and laughed as they marched out into the corridor. The Baron spotted three workmen who looked as if they wanted to become invisible. "Get back in there and clean things up."
"You always make a mess of things, don't you, Grandfather?"
The Baron pressed his hands against his head.
"Shut up, damn you!"
Aaliyah began humming repetitive sing-song tunes, designed to drive him mad, no doubt. When a bewildered Paolo pestered him with questions, the Baron slapped him away.
"Leave me alone. You're as bad as your sister."
Confused and startled, Paolo ran off. The girl's grating voice vibrated in his mind until he couldn't stand it. He hurried out of the castle. Barely able to see where he was going, the Baron bumped into one of the blocky Harkonnen statues and rushed toward the sea cliff.
"I'll hurl myself over the edge. I swear it, Abomination, unless you leave me alone."
He got all the way to the windy, rocky brink before the Aaliyah voice at last faded into sweet silence. The Baron dropped to his knees on the high stone walkway, looking with delicious vertigo over the tremendous drop-off. Maybe he should just do it anyway, and fall to the wet, black rocks and churning waves. If the damned face dancers needed him so badly, they could just grow another Gola, and maybe that one wouldn't be so flawed. The Baron Harkonnen would be back. He felt a hand on his shoulder.
Gathering his remaining shreds of dignity, he looked up to see a pug-nosed face dancer staring at him. Though all shapeshifters looked exactly the same to him, he somehow knew this one was Crone.
"What do you want?"
Officiously, the face dancer said, "You and Paolo will depart Caladan and never return. The Great War is proceeding, and the Evermind has decided that he needs the Kwisatz Haderach close to him. Omnius wants you to complete the boy's preparation under his direct supervision in the heart of the Machine Empire. You will depart for Synchrony as soon as a ship is ready." The Baron flicked his gaze past the face dancer to Paolo, who crouched by a Harkonnen statue, close enough to eavesdrop on the conversation. He chuckled to himself, for this boy was as persistent as Peiter de Vries. As soon as he realized he was discovered, Paolo scampered forward.
"Is he talking about me?"
"Discuss Paolo's destiny with him on the way," Crone said to the Baron. "Do more than explain it. Make the boy believe." "Paolo is inclined to believe anything that reinforces his delusions of grandeur," the Baron said, ignoring the boy. "So, this Kwisatz Haderach business is real?" Even though the face dancers had finally explained the truth to him, the idea still sounded preposterous. He was not convinced that this young Gola could be so important in the grand scheme of things. Crone looked ghastly in his blank stare. Shadows around his eyes darkened as his displeasure became evident.
"I believe it, and so does Omnius. Who are you to question?"
"Believe it, dear grandfather," said the annoying voice. "By his very genes, Paul Atreides has the potential to be greater than you will ever be, in any incarnation."
The Baron refused to reply, either aloud or in his own thoughts. Ignoring the abomination often made her shut up. And now they were going to Synchrony, the home of Omnius. He looked forward to seeing the Thinking Machine Empire. New challenges, new opportunities. In spite of the sum of his first life's memories, the stories of the evil thinking machines and the Butlerian Jihad were too distant to seem relevant. Though he harbored considerable resentment toward the face dancers, he was glad to be on the side of greater strength. Later, during the shuttle ride to orbit, the Baron gazed down at the coastline, the villages, the new smokestacks and strip-mined areas of Caladan. In his excitement, Paolo bustled from window to window.
"Will we have a long journey?"
"I'm not a pilot. How should I know? The thinking machines must be very far away. Otherwise, humans would have known about them long before now."
"What will happen when we get there?"
"Ask a face dancer."
"They won't talk to me."
"Then ask Omnius when you see him.
In the meantime,
amuse yourself."
Paolo sat down beside him in the passenger compartment and began sampling packets of syrupy packaged food.
"I'm special, you know. They've been grooming me, watching over me carefully. What exactly is a Kwisatz Haderach, anyway?"
He wiped his mouth with the back of a hand.
"Don't crawl into their delusions, boy. There is no such thing as a Kwisatz Haderach.
A myth.
A legend. Something with 100 vague explanations in as many prophecies. The entire Bene Gesserit breeding program is utter nonsense."
He recalled from deep memories that he had been part of that breeding program himself, forced to impregnate the vile witch Mohiam. He had humiliated her during the act, but in retaliation the hag had transmitted the debilitating disease that had made him bloated and fat.
"It can't be nonsense. I have visions,"
especially when I take spice tablets. I see it again and again. I've got a bloody knife in my hand, and I'm victorious. I see myself rushing to take my prize. Mélange, but more than mélange. I also see myself lying on the floor, bleeding to death. Which one is right? It's so confusing.
Shut up and take a nap. They docked with an unmarked ship high above Caladan. It bore no markings of the guild and carried no navigator. Wide hangar doors opened, drawing the shuttle up and inside. Silvery figures moved within the cold, airless landing bay, guiding the small vessel into a docking cradle. Robots. Demons from ancient history. Ah, so, at least part of Crone's wild tale might be true. The Baron smiled at the boy staring out the windows. You and I are about to undertake an interesting journey, Paolo.
A sheathed dagger is useless in a fight. A Mala pistol without projectiles is no more than a club. And a Gola without his memories is merely flesh. Paul Atreides, Secret Gola Journals. Now that the Gola of Dr. Yui had his memories restored, Paul Atreides knew he had to attempt more innovative measures to awaken himself. Paul was the oldest of the Gola children, the one with, presumably, the greatest potential, but Shiana and the Bene Gesserit observers had chosen Yui as a test case. Unlike the Sook doctor, however, Paul actually wanted his past back. He longed to remember his life and love with Chaney, his childhood with Duke Leto and Lady Jessica, his friendships with Gurney Halleck and Duncan Idaho. But Paul continued to be haunted by prescient memory visions of his own double death, and he was growing impatient. How could the passengers aboard the no-ship think there was still time for caution? Only a few months ago, they had again narrowly escaped the enemy's net, brighter and stronger than ever before. Of great concern, the saboteur still had not been caught. Though the saboteur had done nothing else as dramatic as the murder of the three axolotl tanks and unborn golas, the danger remained. Paul knew the Ithaca needed him, and he was tired of being just a gola. He had an idea to attempt, one that was both desperate and dangerous, but he didn't hesitate. His real memories hovered like a mirage just beyond the heat-shimmered horizon. With faithful Chaney beside him, he stood outside the hatch that led into the great sand-filled hold. He had told no one else what he intended to do. Over the past 2 years, security had been tightened as much as the Bashar and an eager Thufir Hawat could manage, but no one guarded the entrance to the cargo hold. The seven sandworms were considered sufficiently dangerous to act as their own watchdogs. Only Shiana could safely go among the large creatures, and the last time she had done so, even she had been briefly swallowed up. Paul gazed at Chaney's beautiful elfin face and her thick, dark red hair. Even without prior knowledge, without knowing his destiny was to be with her, he would have found the Fremen girl strikingly attractive. In turn, she ran a methodical eye over his body, his special new suit, his tools.
You look like a real Fremen warrior, Usul.
After studying records and working with a fabrication station in the engineering levels, Chaney had fashioned an authentic steel suit for him, probably the first one manufactured in centuries, and provided him with a rope, maker hooks, and spreaders. The unusual tools felt oddly familiar in his grasp. According to legend, Muad'Dib had summoned a dangerous monster for his first worm ride. These creatures in the hold, though stunted by their captivity, were still behemoths. The hatch opened, and he and Chaney stepped into the artificial desert. When the flinty odors and arid heat struck him, he said, "Stay here, where it's safe. I have to do this alone, or it won't be effective. If I face the worm and ride it, that may jar my memories." Chaney did not try to stop him. She understood the need as well as he did. He climbed up the first rise, leaving footprints in the sand, then raised both hands and shouted, "Shai-Hulud, I have come for you!" In this confined space, he did not need a thumper to summon the worms. A quality in the air changed. He sensed a stirring in the shallow dunes and saw seven serpent-like shapes coming toward him. Instead of running away, he sprinted toward them, selecting a place where he could set up his approach and mount one. His heart pounded. His throat was dry despite the stillsuit mask covering his mouth and nose. Paul had reviewed holofilms to study Fremen's sandriding techniques. Intellectually, he knew what to do, just as, intellectually, he knew the factual details of his past. But a theoretical understanding was far different from actual experience. It occurred to him now, as he stood small and vulnerable on the sand, that the most effective form of learning was in the actual doing, which ensured a more thorough comprehension than he could derive from dusty archives. "I shall learn well," he thought, letting fear wash past him. The nearest worm surged toward him with a rushing sound of scattered sand. The sheer size of the worms grew more incomprehensible as they approached, cresting the dunes. Infusing his heart with courage, Paul forced himself to face this challenge. He held up his hook and spreader and crouched for the first leap. The noise of the monster's approach was so loud that at first he did not hear the woman shouting. From the corner of his eye, he saw Shiana bounding across the dunes, throwing herself in front of him. The largest worm exploded through the dust and reared up, its gigantic round mouth glittering with crystalline teeth. Shiana held up her hands and shouted, "Stop, Shaitan!" The worm hesitated and quested from side to side with its fleshy head as if confused. "Stop! This one is not for you." She placed a firm hand on the chest of Paul's stillsuit and pushed him behind her. "He is not for you, monarch." As if sulking, the largest worm backed away, keeping its eyeless head turned toward them. "Get back to the hatch, foolish boy," Shiana hissed at Paul, using just enough voice to make his legs respond before he could think. Duncan Idaho was also there at the hatchway, glowering. Chaney looked both fearful and relieved. Shiana marched Paul back toward the waiting observers.
"That worm would have destroyed you."
"I'm an Atreides. Shouldn't I be able to control them like you can?"
"That isn't a theory I intend to test with you. You are too important to us. Of all the Golas, if you foolishly throw your life away, what are we to do?"
"But if you protect me too much, you'll never get what you need. Riding a worm would have brought my memories back, I'm sure of it."
"You restored Yui," Chaney pointed out to Shiana. "Why not Usul? He's older."
Yui was expendable, and we weren't sure of what we were doing. "We have already developed specific plans for awaking Liet Kynes and Stilgar, and if we succeed with them, others may follow, including Thufir Hawat and you, Chaney. One day, Paul Atreides will get his chance, but only after we are certain." "What if we don't have the time?" Paul walked away from them, brushing sand and dust from his new stillsuit. Duncan awoke to a loud signal at the door to his quarters. His initial thought was that Shiana had come to him again, despite their mutual reservations. He slid aside the door, ready for an argument. Paul stood there wearing a replica of an Atreides military uniform, which evoked instant respect and loyalty from Duncan. The young man had dressed that way on purpose. Right now, The Gola Paul was almost exactly the same age as the original had been when Erekeen had fallen to the devious Harkonnens, when the first Duncan had died defending him and his mother.
Duncan, you say you were my close friend. You say you knew Paul Atreides. Help me now.
Grasping an ornately carved ivory hilt, the young man drew a blue-white crystalline dagger from a sheath at his waist. Duncan stared in amazement.
A kris knife? It looks... Is it real?
Chaney made it from a worm tooth Shiana found in the cargo hold. In wonder, Duncan touched his fingers to the blade, noting how tough and sharp it was. He drew his thumb along the edge, intentionally cutting himself. He let a single drop of blood fall onto the milky white dagger. According to ancient tradition, a kris knife must never be drawn unless it tastes blood.
I know.
Paul was clearly troubled as he took the weapon back and returned it to its sheath. After hesitating, he blurted out what he had come to say.
Why won't the Bene Gesserits awaken me, Duncan? You need me. Everyone on this no-ship needs me.
Yes, young Master Paul. We do need you. But we need you alive.
You need my abilities as soon as possible. I was the Kwisatz Haderach, and this Gola has the same genetics. Imagine how I could help.
The Kwisatz Haderach. Duncan sighed and sat down on his bed. The Sisterhood spent centuries creating him, but at the same time they were terrified of him. He can supposedly bridge space and time, seeing the future and the past, places even a reverend mother dares not look. Through brute force or guile, he can forge a union between the most diverse of factions. It's a grab bag of tremendous powers.
Whatever those powers are, Duncan, I need them.
And for that, I require my memories. Convince Shiana to try me next. She will do what she will do, at a time of her choosing. You overestimate the influence I have among the sisters.
But what if the enemy's net ensnares us completely?
What if the Kwisatz Haderach is your only hope? Leto II was a Kwisatz Haderach as well, though neither you nor your son turned out exactly the way the Bene Gesserit intended. The sisters are very afraid of anyone who manifests unusual powers. He laughed. After the scattering, when the Sisterhood brought the great Duncan Idaho back, some of them even accused me of being a Kwisatz Haderach. They killed 11 of my Golas, either by Bene Gesserit heretics or Tleilaxu schemers.
But why don't they want these powers?
I thought, oh, they want the powers, Paul, but only under carefully controlled conditions. His heart went out to the young man, who looked so lost and desperate.
I can't do anything without my past, Duncan. Help me retrieve it. You lived through part of it with me. You remember.
Oh, I remember you very well. Duncan laced his hands behind his head and leaned back. I remember your christening on Caladan after you were nearly killed by Imperial intrigues as an infant. I remember how Duke Leto's whole family was put at risk in the War of Assassins. I was given the great honor of taking you to safety, and you and I went to the wilds of Caladan. We stayed with your exiled grandmother Helena, and we hid among the Caladan primitives. That was when you and I became so close. Yes, I remember it very well.
I don't, Paul said with a sigh.
Duncan seemed caught in a loop of his past lives. Caladan, Dune, the Harkonnens, Aaliyah, hate. Do you know what you're asking me?
about your memories, about your life. The Tleilaxu created my first Gola as an assassination tool. They manipulated me because I was your friend. They knew you could not turn me away, even though you saw the trap. I wouldn't have turned you away, Duncan. I had the knife raised against you, ready to strike, but in the last instant, I collided with myself. The programmed assassin hate became the loyal Duncan Idaho. You can't imagine the agony. He pointed a stern finger at the young man. Restoring your past will require a similar crisis. Paul squared his jaw. I'm prepared for it. I'm not afraid of pain. Wrinkling his brow, Duncan said, You're too content, young Paul, because your Chaney grounds you. She makes you stable and happy, and that's a severe drawback. In contrast, look at Yui. He fought against remembering with every fiber of his being, and that's what broke him. But you? What fulcrum can they use on you, Paul Atreides? We'll just have to find something. Are you really ready to accept it? Duncan leaned forward, offering no mercy. What if the only way you can have your past restored is that you must lose Chaney? What if she has to die bleeding in your arms before you can remember? More than anything, I need my father to know I did not fail. I do not want him to die thinking I was unworthy of his genes. The Cytale, Gola. No ship security interview. It must be built according to precise standards, insisted the old Tleilaxu. His voice cracked. Precise standards! I will take care of it, father. The Gola, only 13, tended the degenerating master who sat in a stiff armchair. Old Cytale refused to lie down until a traditional bier for his body was built. He intentionally kept his austere living quarters locked to keep others away. He had no desire to be interrupted or harassed during his dying days. The Tleilaxu master's organs, joints, and skin had begun to fail in increasingly problematic ways. It reminded him of how the no-ship itself seemed to be breaking down, its systems failing as air leaked into space. Water was inexplicably lost. Food stores went missing. Some of the more paranoid refugees saw sabotage in every flickering glow panel, and many turned their suspicious eyes toward the Tleilaxu. It was another reason for him to grumble. At least he would soon be gone. I thought you said my beer was already being built. It cannot be rushed. The teenager bowed his head. Do not worry. I am following the strict laws of the Shariat. Show it to me, then. Your own beer? But that is meant to carry your body only after you... Old Cytale glowered with his dark eyes. Purge those useless emotions. You have become too involved in this process. It is shameful. Am I not supposed to care about you, father? I see your pain. Stop calling me father. Think of me as yourself. Once you become me, I will not be dead. No need for weeping. Each of our incarnations is disposable, so long as the memory train continues uninterrupted. Young Cytale tried to regain his composure. You are still a father to me, no matter what memories are buried inside me. Will I stop feeling these emotions when my old life is restored? Of course. At that glorious moment, you will understand the truth and your obligations. Cytale grabbed the young man by his shirt and pulled his face close. Where are your memories?
What if I were to die tomorrow?
Old Cytail knew death was imminent, but he had dramatized his infirmity in an attempt to shock his replacement. The premature construction of the bier was yet another attempt to provoke a crisis. If only the two of them could be back on Tlilox, where full immersion in the holy traditions of the great belief would be enough to trigger even the most stubborn of Golas. Here on board a godless no-ship, the difficulties seemed insurmountable. This should never have taken so long.
I have failed you.
The roomy eyes flashed. You are not only failing me, you are failing your people. If you do not awaken our whole race, our entire history and all the knowledge in my mind will vanish from the universe. Do you want to be responsible for that? I refuse to believe God has turned his back on us entirely. Our fate, lamentably, depends upon you. The Gola looked crestfallen, as if an unsupportable weight rested on his shoulders. I am doing all I can to achieve that goal, Father. He said the word deliberately. And until I succeed, you must do all you can to remain alive. He's finally showing a little strength, Cytail thought bitterly. But it's not enough. Days later, the Gola stood by his father's deathbed, his own deathbed. He felt as if he were having an out-of-body experience, watching his life slip away moment by moment. It gave the boy an oddly disconnected feeling. Since emerging from the axolotl tank, Cytail had loved only one person. Himself. Both his older self and the self he was going to be. The degenerating man had provided cells from his own body, cells that held all his memories and experiences, all the knowledge of the Tliloxu. But he hadn't provided the key to unlock them. No matter how hard the young Gola strained, his memories obstinately refused to emerge. He clutched the old man's hand.
Not yet, Father.
I've tried and tried. With near sightless eyes, old Cytail glared at his counterpart.
Why do you disappoint me so?
Yui had been restored to his past life, and two other Golas, Stilgar and Liet Kynes, were even now being raked over the mental coals. How could mere witches succeed where a Tliloxu master failed? Bene Gesserits should never have been so adept at triggering the avalanche of experiences. If Cytail could not do it, the Tliloxu would be relegated to the dustbins of history. The old man on the bed coughed and wheezed, while the younger leaned close, tears trickling down his cheeks. Old Cytail spat blood. His disappointment and utter despair were palpable. An insistent signal at the door announced the arrival of two Sook doctors. The bespectacled rabbi was obviously repulsed by his duties, while young Yui still appeared to be shaken by the recent return of his memories. Cytail could see in their eyes that they both knew the older master would perish very soon. Among the witches there were other Sook practitioners, but Cytail had insisted on being tended only by the rabbi, and only when absolutely necessary. They were all unclean powinda, but at least the rabbi wasn't a disgusting female. Or perhaps Cytail should choose Wellington Yui over the old Jew. The old Tliloxu master had to accept certain medical examinations, if only to keep himself alive until his son reawakened. Cytail lifted his head. Go away. We are praying. Do you think I like tending to Golas? To filthy Tliloxu? Do you think I want to be here?
You can both die for all I care.
Yui, though, moved forward with a medical kit, easing the younger Saitail aside to check the dying man's vital signs. Behind Yui, the rabbi squinted through his spectacles with vulture eyes. It won't be long now.
Such an odd old holy man, young Saitail thought. Even compared to the smells of disinfectant, medicine, and sickness, he'd always had an odd smell about him.
Sounding compassionate, Yui said, "There isn't much we can do." Gasping for air, old Saitail croaked out, "A Tleilaxu master should not be so weak and decrepit. It is unseemly." His youthful counterpart tried again to trigger the flow of memories, to squeeze them into his brain by sheer force of will, as he had attempted to do countless times before. The essential past must be in there somewhere, buried deep. But he felt no tickle of possibilities, no glimmer of success. What if they are not there at all? What if something had gone terribly wrong? His pulse pounded as the panic began to rise. Not much time. Never enough time. He tried to cut off the thought. The body provided a wealth of cellular material. They could create more Saitail Golas, try again and again if necessary. But if his own memories had failed to resurface, why should an identical Gola have any better luck without the guidance of the original? I am the only one who knew the master so intimately. He wanted to shake Yui, demand to know how he had managed to remember his past. Tears were in full flow now, falling onto the old man's hand, but Saitail knew they were inadequate. His father's chest spasmed in an almost imperceptible death rattle. The life support equipment hummed with more intensity, and the instrument readings fluctuated. He's slipped into a coma, Yui reported. The rabbi nodded. Like an executioner announcing his plans, he said, "Too weak. He's going to die now." Saitail's heart sank. He has given up on me. His father would never know if he succeeded now. He would perish wondering and worrying. The last great calamity in a long line of disasters that had befallen the Tleilaxu race. He gripped the old man's hand. So cold, too cold. He felt the life ebbing. I have failed. As if felled by a stunner, Saitail dropped to his knees at the bedside. In his crashing despair, he knew with absolute certainty that he could never resurrect the recalcitrant memories. Not alone. Lost. Forever lost. Everything that comprised the great Tleilaxu race. He could not bear the magnitude of this disaster. The reality of his defeat sliced like shattered glass into his heart. Abruptly, the Tleilaxu youth felt something changing inside, followed by an explosion between his temples. He cried out from the excruciating pain. At first he thought he was dying himself, but instead of being swallowed in blackness, he felt new thoughts burning like wildfire across his consciousness. Memories streamed past in a blur, but Saitail locked onto each one, absorbing it again and reprocessing it into the synapses of his brain. The precious memories returned to where they had always belonged. His father's death had opened the barriers. At last, Saitail retrieved what he was supposed to know, the critical databank of a Tleilaxu master, all the ancient secrets of his race. Instilled with pride and a new sense of dignity, he rose to his feet. Wiping away warm tears, he looked down at the discarded copy of himself on the bed. It was nothing more than a withered husk. He no longer needed that old man.
These Gola children contain old souls that are not unlike the voices in a reverend mother's other memory. The challenge is to access and exploit these old souls. Ship's log, entry of Duncan, Idaho. In the gangly body of a teenager, filled with the memories of a long life and the shame of things he had done, Wellington Yui walked with painstaking slowness. Each step brought him closer to the moment he had been dreading. The skin of his brow burned where a diamond tattoo should have been. At least he no longer displayed that lie. Yui knew that if he ever intended to make this life different from his error-prone past, he must confront the terrible things he had done. Here, thousands of years later, and on the other side of the universe, House Atreides lived all around him. Paul Atreides, Lady Jessica, Duncan Idaho, Thufir Hawat. At least Duke Leto had not been resurrected as a Gola. Not yet. Yui didn't think he could bear to look into the eyes of the man he had betrayed. Facing Jessica would be tough enough. Walking ponderously toward her quarters, Yui heard voices ahead, a child's giggle and a woman's rebuke. Suddenly, little Aaliyah toddled out of one doorway and ducked into another, followed by a scolding proctor. The two-year-old was extremely precocious, with a hint of the genius that the first Aaliyah had been. The spice saturation in the axolotl tank had altered her somewhat, but she didn't possess the complete other memory of her predecessor. The proctor followed and sealed the door behind them. Neither of them had glanced at Yui. Aaliyah was the most recent Gola to be born. The program had been stalled since the horrific murder of the three tanks and unborn children. At least that is one crime I do not have on my conscience. But the Bene Gesserits would soon begin the program again. They were already discussing which cells to implant in the new axolotl tanks. Irulan? Emperor Shaddam himself? Count Fenring? Or someone far worse? Yui shuddered at the thought. He feared that the witches had gone beyond true need and now were just toying with lives, letting their infernal curiosity sidestep all caution. He paused in front of Jessica's quarters, steeling himself. I will face my fear. Wasn't that part of the litany the witches so often quoted? In their present incarnations as Golas, Jessica and Yui had been close enough to think of themselves as friends. But since becoming Dr. Wellington Yui again, everything was different. Now I have a second chance, he thought. But my road to redemption is long, and the incline very steep. Jessica opened her door at his signal. Oh, hello, Wellington. My grandson and I were just reading a holo book about Paul's younger years, one of those tomes Princess Irulan was always writing. She invited him inside, where he saw Leto II sitting cross-legged on the carpeted floor. Leto was a loner, though he frequently spent time with his grandmother. Yui twitched nervously when she closed the door behind them, as if to seal his doom and prevent escape. He kept his eyes down, and after a deep sigh, he said, I wish to apologize to you, my lady, though I know you can never forgive me. Jessica placed an arm on his shoulder. We've been through this. You can't bear the blame for things that were done so long ago. It wasn't really you. Yes, it was, because I remember it all now. We Golas were created for one purpose, and we must accept the consequences. Jessica looked at him impatiently. We all know what you did, Wellington. I accepted that and forgave you long ago. But will you do it again after you remember? One day those vaults will be opened in your mind, the terrible old wounds.
We've got to face the guilt our predecessors left for us, or we'll be consumed by things we never did. It's uncharted territory for all of us. But I suspect we each have plenty of things to atone for. She tried to console him, but he didn't feel he deserved it. Leto paused the film book and looked up with an eerie intelligence in his eyes. Well, I'm only going to take responsibility for what I do in this life. Jessica reached out to touch Yui's face gently. I can't understand what you went through. What you're still going through. I'll know soon enough, I suppose. But you should think about what you would like to be, not what you're afraid of being. She made it sound so simple, but despite his best efforts, he had been twisted before. What if I do something bad in this lifetime, too? Jessica's expression hardened. Then no one can help you. You think your eyes are open, yet you do not see. Bene Gesserit admonishment. Water crashed against the black reef on Boozle, sending up a veil of spray. Mother Commander Mirbella stood with the once disgraced sister at the edge of the cove, watching amphibians frolic in deep water. The amphibious creatures swam together, slick and smooth-skinned, diving under the combers and then bursting to the surface again. They love their new freedom, Carista said. Like dolphins in an ancient earth sea, Mirbella thought, admiring their forms. Human, and yet dramatically not so. I'm more interested in seeing them harvest Sue stones. She turned her face into the salty wind. Gray clouds were gathering, but the air remained warm and humid. Our debts in this war are staggering. Our credit is stretched beyond its limits, and some of our most vital suppliers will accept nothing but hard currency, like Sue stones. In the months since leaving Okuliat, the Mother Commander had traveled from planet to planet, studying humanity's defenses. Realizing their great peril, local kings, presidents, and warlords provided independent battleships to add to the newly constructed guild vessels being released by the junction shipyards. Every government and cluster of allied worlds scrambled to invent or acquire new armaments to use against the enemy, but so far nothing had proved effective. The Ixians were still testing the obliterator weapons, which had proved to be more difficult to manufacture than expected. Mirbella continued to demand more work, more material, and sacrifices. It wouldn't be enough. And the war continued. Plagues spread. Machine fleets destroyed every human-inhabited world they encountered. Near the edge of one of the main combat zones, three more Shiana surrogates rallied the people caught between a hammer and an anvil, but to no avail. So far, since the beginning of Omnius's march across space, Mirbella could not claim a single clear victory. In her bleakest moments, the odds seemed poor and the obstacles insurmountable. Millennia ago, the fighters of the Butlerian Jihad had faced another impossible situation, and humankind had won only by accepting an appalling cost. They had unleashed countless atomic weapons that not only destroyed thinking machines, but also trillions of human beings who had been held in slavery. The Pyrrhic victory had left a horrendous stain on the human soul. And now, even after that monumental sacrifice, Omnius was back, like a noxious weed whose roots had never been destroyed. Gauging the progress of the thinking machines, in the next year or two, the human race would be forced into a climactic showdown. Once the Ixian industrialists delivered their long-awaited obliterators, all the collected militaries from planet after planet would draw a line in space. As far as she was concerned, that opportunity could not come soon enough.
Our Suestone shipments have increased every month for the past 2 years. As she spoke, Carista did not remove her gaze from the frolicking aquatic creatures. The Phibians are more productive now that the honored Matres have stopped torturing them. And they never used to play like that.